Support for this podcast is made possible in part by our members. Become a member of WNTI by visiting our ePledge page at WNTI.org.
You're listening to Contours, WNTI's Issues and Arts program. Now your host, Melanie Teal.
Good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Contours. Today on the show, you'll get two interviews from Bill Nutt. First, The Romantics' Wally Palmer. The Romantics are playing at the Mayo Performing Arts Center on August 7th. And then Bobby Caldwell, who's appearing here at the Centenary Stage on August 9th. First on today's show, Dr. Carl Hricko interviews Mark Schoengold, our world traveler, about his latest trip to Colombia, South America. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy the show.
Between Venezuela, Brazil, Ecuador, Peru, and Panama is the South American country of Colombia. It's classified geographically into five natural regions, from the Andes mountain range to the Pacific Ocean coastal region to the Caribbean Sea coastal region to the plains and to the Amazon rainforest region. Colombia is the only South American country which borders both the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans. This beautiful country is not only known for its coffee, but for its emeralds, the myth of El Dorado, its tropical landscapes, and its capital of Bogota. Well, just returning from a most interesting tour of Colombia is our world traveler and guest, Mark Schoengold. Welcome to Contours, Mark.
Thanks again for having me, Carl.
Oh, okay. And hey, tell us what happened on your trip to Colombia.
Well, the first thing is that many people are kind of afraid to go there.
Oh, why is that?
And because of the reputation it's had for the drug trade.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
But that was mostly in the 90s, and today it is though it's still there, and the political parties have some fighting, it's a relatively safe country to visit, so I would recommend people go there. It's not a dangerous place to go to.
Yeah.
And there are some very nice things about traveling there. It's a five-hour flight from where we live in Jersey. Same time zone. You don't need a visa for American citizens. You don't need malaria pills. So in many ways, it's an easier country to visit and deal with than a lot of other countries.
How long does it take to get there?
5 hours.
5 hours, huh?
Oh. 5 hours, and you land in Bogota, which is the gateway for most travelers. It's unusual. You figure you're landing in South America, and it's warm, but Bogota is at 8,600 feet.
Oh.
So you have to realize that you may have some chilly nights there and maybe a little rain, but it is a very modern city, 8 million people. That's 20% of the entire country. And it's a great place to start a vacation in Colombia.
So you stayed at a hotel there, I guess, huh?
Yes. We stayed in hotels and lodges, and they were very fine, no problems at all, no problems with food. You do need to have bottled water. Of course, you're in a foreign country, but that's to be expected.
Don't drink the water, huh?
Right. Be careful. Yeah. Always be careful.
Okay. So, after the first night, then, how do you start off on your trip?
Well, you see the capital first, Bogota, and you visit the classic spots. You go to the Gold Museum, which has over 10,000 artifacts, one of the largest gold museums in the world. Very beautiful, a lot of pre-Columbian material. Then you're going to visit the marketplaces and see where they sell flowers and other types of products that are famous for Colombia. And then in the evening, you can go up and see the city view. They have a funicular that takes you up on top of the mountains looking over Bogota and have a beautiful view of the city.
It's
a very nice place.
Did you see Emerald City?
We did not see El Dorado.
I didn't see El Dorado either, huh?
No, we didn't see that. But the country, because it is part of the Andes, there's a lot of volcanic activity, there's earthquake activity, and this is where a lot of these gems and minerals form from molten rocks shooting up into the cores of these mountain ranges.
Ah.
So there's a lot of material like that in Colombia.
Okay. And so your first stop on the tour was Bogota, of course, because you landed there. And then afterwards, where did you go?
From there, we went off to the Amazon. Colombia does border the Amazon, and you have to fly basically everywhere because there are three prongs of the Andes protruding through Colombia.
Huh.
And the rides would be very long and windy, and there are landslides because it's steep. So you fly everywhere. So you fly down to the border of Brazil, and you do the passport control, and you get into the Colombian-Brazilian border, which, of course, is, again, is a tourist attraction. And there are all sorts of things to see. You get on the boats. It's a different way of life there. You have small villages, but they still have cell phones. And,
oh, really?
And they have, you know, the dishes for the TV. It's still there.
Simple
in other ways, but it's not. They want those modern conveniences. And then we saw all sorts of things. We saw monkeys. They climbed all over us. There were snakes. There were sloths, slow sloths. There are caiman in the waters. And, of course, there are plenty of birds, like the macaws. And there are even pink and gray dolphins, if you're really lucky, and you can see them swimming in the river.
Did you see any dolphins?
Just glimpses.
Yeah, just
They're
glimpses.
They're very difficult to see.
So how about those monkeys? What kind are they?
There were squirrel monkeys that were very, very, shall we say, tame. That's the wrong word to use, but they were very curious. And there are certain places where you are allowed to feed them, and then they are all over you. There was like 10 on me. They're hanging all over the place. But that's unusual. I mean, those are really like for tourists, but the monkeys are in the jungle. And you can hear them.
Yeah.
And it is the Amazon, so there's going to be plenty of wildlife there.
Did you go into the jungle itself?
A little bit. We did hike in there, and, you know, there are snakes, there are spiders, there are things that bite, and you have to even be careful with the plants. They could have thorns. So you go with the guide. The guide tells you what to do, and you do what he says.
Okay. So after that, what happened?
After that, we went into the interior of the country to see all of the Andean villages and cities. So now you're in a different way of life. It's simpler, but they're all pretty well set up the same as the Spaniards set them up, with the central plazas and the churches. Colombia is a tremendously religious country. Well over 90% Catholic, and they cross themselves for no reason at all. It's a very, very religious country. So you're going to see a lot of the churches and cathedrals, and they're very interesting to see. But you also see again a simpler way of life. You see markets which are selling more native types of foods, and of course their dress. So that was very nice to see. There are also pre-Columbian parks to visit where you will see all sorts of statues from all of the Indian cultures. A lot of it is recently discovered. Some of it's 5,000 years old. And there's a lot of archaeological sites. And you can be there for as long as you want. They go on and on and on. If that's your forte, that's what you like, you'll see plenty of that.
Now, you mentioned food. Did you eat any of the food, and what kind of food?
The food is, there's tropical foods and the fruits and so on, but the most interesting thing I did was they actually served me a plate, and the plate was made out of volcanic rocks, since there's plenty of volcanic stuff there, and what they do is they heat the plate, not the food, and they heat this volcanic rock up to 1,000 degrees. And when they put it on your table, you cannot touch it because obviously you'll get severely burned. And then they give you your meat raw. And what happens is they put the meat on your plate, and then you cut the meat and you sear it on your hot plate to your taste. So you like it rare, you like it medium, you like it well done. I've never experienced anything like this before. And the plate is so hot, and they have it insulated; it just doesn't get cold. and everybody's happy because you get it cooked to exactly the way you want to eat it.
So when they say don't touch the plate, they really mean it.
I mean, they really mean it. I mean, this is a real serious business out, and this is done in the interior. I didn't see this in any of the major cities or anything. This is like a type of specialty thing when you're out in the countryside.
What about the coffee? They're always talking about Colombian coffee.
The coffee is very interesting because most of it is exported because they'll make more money. So you actually get kind of the second-rate coffee if you're in Colombia itself.
Oh, really?
Can you buy the top brand? You can, but that, you know, it's going to be very expensive. So people are drinking the second-rate coffee. And you can visit the coffee plantations, and they will take you through the process and show you all the beans. And you can get a PhD practically in coffee because they love to go explain everything there is about it. And by the way, their economy rises and falls with coffee. It's such a major product. And many of the civil wars they've had over the last 100 years, because there's a lot of division with the politics and so on, and sometimes that can be tied to the economy. So it's, and the price of coffee and other products. So Colombia is relatively stable now, but you never know.
Our guest is Mark Schongold, a world traveler, and he's talking about his recent trip to Colombia, South America. Mark, our last part of the trip was on the border of Colombia and Brazil. Where'd you go afterwards?
After that, we went along the coastline, and we went to a beautiful city and a very old city called Cartagena that was formed and founded right after Columbus, not too long after Columbus discovered the New World. And beautiful colonial city with a beautiful fort, a Spanish fort, looking over the oceans, you know, for protection. There was always battles. And from there, that's sort of like the gateway to out into the ocean, where you can then explore the reefs that are there. And you can go snorkeling or diving in a lot of the offshore islands. There's a lot of day trips that they will take you out to that area, and you can visit. So it's a beautiful city. There's lots of markets. It's a real tourist attraction, well over 1 million people. And you can also fly home from there if you want to. You don't have to go back to the capital.
Oh, okay. Okay. Did you get a chance to go to Brazil?
We were in actually Brazil and Peru, because as you go along the river, part of the Amazon tributary, sometimes if you're on one side of the river, you're in one country, and if you're on the other side of the river, you're in the other country. Yeah. So I was in Peru, I think, 3 or 4 times, but when you're on the river, you don't have to show any passports or anything. It's pretty open when it comes to things like that.
Yeah.
So one problem we had between countries was during an election day. They had an election for parliament, and Colombia actually closes their border. And we had just passed through Brazilian passport control, and we're in no man's land going towards Colombia. It's just like a mile-long street. Yeah. You can see all the signs in Portuguese and Spanish because it's, you know, it's Brazilian, Colombian. And we couldn't get back in the country. Neither could our guide. And we sort of had to shall we say, grease the palms in order for us to kind of sneak in and around the major thoroughfare to get into the country. I mean, we were tourists. It shouldn't have affected us at all. But for some reason or other, it was some sort of problem. But they're very serious about elections.
Yeah, that's understandable from what you say. Wow. So you got back to Colombia, and things went well, I guess, afterwards, huh?
Yes, then we got back into, and we also went into some of the valley regions, which are really beautiful. There's the Magdalena River, which is the largest in the country, and there are beautiful spots to stop along the way and see the river and see a lot of the farming and so the produce that they sell. And in a lot of these places, unlike in many countries, you can go horseback riding, and there's really no limit. In other words, here in the U.S., can only walk in many places like in New Jersey because of insurance purposes, whatever. Here you can gallop and enjoy the ride and take them down to the beach. and have a lot of fun. So it was very nice and very reasonably priced. So it's very nice to be able to do something like that.
Speaking about the transportation, besides horseback riding, what other forms of transportation do they have?
Well, other than the cars and planes, it's pretty much it. There's no railroads. The railroads that started to be built in the late 1800s and early 1900s became corrupt. Politicians siphoned money off of them, and there are no passenger railroads in the country. I think there's one small railroad that transfers coal from one place to another, but there are no railways. They're thinking about trying to institute them again, but that really is a hindrance to transportation. I hadn't been in a country that didn't have any railroads, but it was a political problem again, and hopefully something like that will be fixed over time.
Wow. Get a chance to find out any information about their education system.
If you're in the capital, you have all the schools, you have religious schools, you have the universities. If you're out in the countryside, I think the elementary education is mandatory, though they don't really check very much. But there's no reason why you cannot be educated in Columbia. That should not be a problem.
If you desired it, sure.
Right. Schools can be expensive in some cases, but it's not like people are denied, such as in other countries.
Yeah. Now you said you returned back to Colombia after the elections took place. You snuck back into the country again as tourists.
Right.
Where did you go after that?
Well, we pretty much went back to, we flew to Cartagena, the coast, after that. And that pretty much was the end of the trip when we were visiting the coastline and going offshore. So they actually had closed the border a day before they should have. That's why we kind of got caught. But remember, Colombia is three times the size of California.
Yeah.
It's one-ninth the size of the U.S. So we were there for 3 weeks, but surely, you know, it's like saying, you know, I saw the U.S. in a few weeks. You can't. So, I mean, there's a lot of country to see, and we have a nice taste of it, but there's a lot more to see. You can really go throughout the country and see all the villages and get a real taste of what it's like.
Ah, okay. And if you compare Cartagena with Bogota, is there any difference, or are they essentially the same?
Well, Bogota's going to have the high rises, eight times bigger with population, so it's a much busier town, more developed. And as I said, Cartagena has that fort. It's a more genteel, colonial-looking, laid-back type of town. And it looks more like a tourist type of town to visit than Bogota, which is, you know, the capital and the busy city. Our next trip will be a safari to Zimbabwe and Zambia. Our next foreign trip will be there. We haven't visited those two countries, and we will actually be doing a walking safari, which has me a little nervous.
Because
everything obviously is faster than we are, but hopefully we'll be in good hands as we walk across where all of these animals will be free and open.
Yeah, wow. Well, looking forward to talking to you about your next trip then on the safari. And in the meantime, thank you for being on our program, Contours, Mark, as usual. And wish you the best of luck in the future. And thank you again for telling us about your tour of Colombia, South America.
Thank you for inviting me.
WNTI and Kennedy Event Services are bringing live music to Knowlton as we present WNTI Stage August 15th, 16th, and 17th at the Knowlton Lions Club Pavilion on Route 46 in Delaware, New Jersey. A weekend of food, fun, and two stages of nonstop music under the big tent. Beer and wine concessions sponsored by the Knowlton Lions Club and free Wi-Fi by CenturyLink. The fest begins on Friday night with WNTI favorite The Grand Slambovians with opening act Billy Hector at the Cafe Stage. Other acts for the weekend include Marshall Crenshaw, the Devil Nellies, John Ginty and Todd Wolf, as well as many local favorites. So please join us for 3 days of summer fun, August 15th, 16th, and 17th at the Knowlton Lions Club Pavilion on Route 46 in Delaware, New Jersey. No pets and no coolers, please. Free parking. Schedules, tickets, and information available online at WNTIstage.org.
In the late 1970s and early 80s, there was this great bubble where a lot of bands and individual artists were combining the energy of punk with the melody of the best 1960s pop. And the result were a series of great power pop bands. One of the more memorable were the Romantics. Songs such as What I Like About You, Talking in Your Sleep, put them on the map. I'm happy to say that the Romantics will be playing on a bill that includes Marshall Crenshaw, the Smithereens, Tommy Two-Tone, all acts that kind of come from that same era. And I'm even happier to say that Wally Palmer of the Romantics is here on the line with us. It's a pleasure for me to say, Wally, welcome to the WNTI airwaves.
Hey, well, thank you very much, Bill. Pleasure for myself to be on board with you today.
Now, I made it sound maybe a little bit calculating that, okay, we're going to take the energy of punk and the melody of pop. What did you guys have in mind when you created the Romantics on Valentine's Day, 1977?
Well, you know, Bill, here's the thing. You have to go back a little bit further, you know, back in history, a few years to, you know, the east side of Detroit, or, you know, where we all kind of grew up from, different areas of the east side. But the whole thing is we would see each other before we were really formally introduced. We would see each other at different shows coming through the area, you know, playing in town. Like bands out of the, you know, the West Coast, out of England, whoever would come through town, we, you know, you'd see each other. And then, you know, before you knew it, you started talking because you see each other at the same shows. So, and introduced by one individual or something to one another, you know, we started talking at that point and, you know, well, what do you do? What do you do? You know, and stuff. And we were all in like different bands. Actually, Mike and Jimmy, our original drummer, were in the same band together. Myself and Rich were in another band together doing other, you know, doing shows at the same time. So they said, why don't you come out and see us play? We're playing here and there. And then at the same token, we said, well, yeah, we got shows here and there. So we'd go see each other's bands play. Then it was obvious that there was a common thread between all of us. So we got together at one point, just said, well, not really happy with what I'm doing right now. You know, you guys happy with the stuff you're doing in your band? They said, well, yeah, kind of. And then we got the idea of getting together and just seeing what kind of songs we can bang out, seeing that we had the same basic influences, and, you know, and it just worked, you know, once we got it in motion.
I think a lot of people, when they hear Detroit has such a rich musical history, obviously Motown, but also you're talking, you know, Ted Nugent and Alice Cooper and a lot of other bands came out of that era. Who were the shows that you would see these other guys at? Who were the guys that you were following at the time?
Aside from seeing the bands that you just mentioned, we would, and going out to see them play live, you know, you were limited because we were at that point not really underage, but, you know, going back a few years, like I said, we had AM radio because FM was just coming into its own at that point in the late 60s, you know. So we would see bands on TV, for instance, and then go see them live whenever we could if it was an all-ages show or something. And talking about like Mitch Ryder and Bob Seger and then eventually the MC5 and the Stooges, you know, and the Rationals, bands like that. So we pulled a lot from them because we saw them the most. And then, you know, on TV, you'd see on certain shows, you end up seeing all the English bands that we really liked a lot, too. For instance, obviously, like the Beatles and the Stones and the you know, the Who and the Kinks and, you know, whoever else was on American TV at that time. You know, so we were able to pull from all that. And as you said a couple minutes ago, is that we were, you know, being from Detroit, you would always, Detroit radio always favored local bands anyways, but there was no denying that, you know, Motown was so prevalent. And so you'd hear a lot of that and see a lot of that. And the same thing with the white rock bands that I mentioned just a little while ago. So all that, you throw all that in a blender, essentially, and that's what we came up with.
We're talking with Wally Palmer of the Romantics. There are a number of songs I could ask about. I've got to start with kind of the obvious.
Yep.
And it's a song that didn't really take off immediately, but has since come to represent that whole era. Did you guys know what you were doing when you recorded What I Like About You? Did you realize it would take on the life that it's taken on?
Well, at that point, when we recorded the first album, we had, under our belts, we had probably about 20 songs or something, or, you know, somewhere in that area, and playing them out live, you know, and stuff quite a bit, and that was just, you know, one of the songs. And when it came time to record the first album, we only, we did, I think it was 11 songs on that first album that ended up on the first album, same, but we recorded about 16 or something at that point. Mm-hmm. And that happened to be one of them. And you knew automatically that when that song was recorded and when we started to hear the playbacks, you knew there was something special about it. But we had no idea until it was finally mixed and the rest of the album was mixed that was going to be the track that, you know, catapulted that album. And, you know, but all the other songs obviously were all favorites of ours.
Sure.
Some, let's just say, some got better treatment than others. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's no denying that, you know, you caught, there was something magic about it and you could tell.
Well, you have, it starts off with that just killer riff.
Yeah.
In fact, I hope you take this in the spirit in which I say it. It's a song that sounds so good, it sounds like a cover. It sounds like, well, that song's been around forever, hasn't it?
Well, let me tell you something else. Funny you say that, too. Someone else brought this to my attention. He's just a close friend, you know, from another band and stuff, and he said, you know, whether you guys realize it or not, that song, whenever the band will get together for kids or something, that's one of the songs that, like, everybody knows and they want to learn how to play. It's almost, so in other words, what he is saying, he goes, you know, you guys have written, for this decade, you guys, you know, wrote a song very similar to, like, Louie Louie was, you know, when every band, when you first started a band back when we were growing up, you know, that was like a common song in Gloria, Louie Louie, you know, so you've written like a Louie Louie for this generation.
That's something, that alone is something to be proud of.
Absolutely. I mean, I never think of it that way, but, you know, I guess in its simplicity and stuff, it's, I guess it falls into that category.
Let's fast forward a couple of years. The best-selling single, if you just go by sales, tell me about Talking in Your Sleep.
Talking in Your Sleep, I could tell you this, that it was a bigger song internationally because of its chart success than What I Like About You. Mm-hmm. Longevity-wise, What I Like About You, I would say, you know, you hear it more like sporting events and blah, 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 this and that, or TV commercials and movies and that. But Talking in Your Sleep, though, and, you know, and when we recorded the album In Heat, it was a song that we had before. It was an unfinished track, and we had recorded all the rest of the songs for the album, and all of us as a joint, with our producer at that time, Pete Sowley, we said, well, you know what, we still got this one track. It's a really cool groove, mm-hmm. you know, but it wasn't finished yet. And everyone liked the song so much where we said, you know what, we owe it to ourselves. Let's put an effort into finishing this song up. And it was the last song that we finished up. We took time aside, a day or two, to work out, you know, lyrics, and I had kind of a melody I was bouncing around with and, you know, phrasing for it. And so we finished the song up, we laid it down, and sure enough, that was the song that kick-started that album.
Isn't it funny how sometimes those things that come together at the end are the ones that really push something forward like that?
Oh, yeah, that and a lot of times, you know, it's an old saying, though, but it says, you know, the more simple it is, the easier it is for people to grasp. And if it's a simple song or simplicity, you know, that'll take it to that next level, I guess. And then, you know, in a lot of cases, that does ring very true.
So let's fast forward even more. I'm really pleased to see that the band playing as the Romantics really is the Romantics. It's three of the four original members. Is that am I correct in that?
Yes, you are. As a matter of fact, up front is myself and you know, and Mike Skill and Rich Cole, you know, which are the same three people that were up front. And that, if anybody remembers the first video for What I Like About You or whatever, or that, you know, three out of four original guys at this point in time, 35 years down the road, I guess is pretty good, pretty impressive.
So what makes a Romantic show now different from then? What are you guys able to do, or what are you bringing to the songs now that maybe you weren't able to do 30 plus years ago?
Well, let me tell you, one thing that's automatic to me is that we're doing almost the whole first album and pretty much parts of the second album, a good portion of the second album live, which even when we recorded the first album, I've heard tapes of us from shows from that same time frame in 1980 and 81, 82, 83. A lot of the songs, we never did those songs live, but, you know, but now we are. And I'm not quite sure why it is. Maybe it's we just want to, and it's just and we just wanted to show more than just you know, a hard rocking, you know, what we did back then, which we still do now too. But we, you know, some of the songs showcase, you know, different harmonies and stuff like this, and we felt it was an appropriate time to learn those and get them back in the set.
I mentioned at the top that you're on a tour, Rock of the 80s, and I neglected to mention that you're going to be playing the Mayo Performing Arts Center in Morristown on August 7th. You're on a bill with Marshall Crenshaw, Tommy Tutone, and the Smithereens. What's the commonality there? What do you appreciate about those other acts, and what do you like about being on the same bill with them?
Well, you know, someone was telling me not too long ago too that it's for some reason, he goes, man, it seems like, you know, that songs from that era is like, you know, they're like really popular now and stuff. And then we started a conversation. I said, well, you know what, all those, if you think about it, all those bands were kind of weaned on songs from the, you know, 60s and early 70s and stuff. And it's that the pinpointing on the song itself, you know, the melodic, you know, what, and you can put it in whatever category you want, whether it's, you want to call it power pop or whatnot or soda pop, I don't know, whatever. The bottom line is, it's the same kind of mentality, and there's a common thread through all four of the bands and acts playing on there, you know. And plus, we all know each other from meeting each other before, and we're all, you know, we appreciate each other's efforts in that. And so it makes for, it's going to make for a great time, and it's going to make for a great show.
We've been talking with Wally Palmer of the Romantics. Wally, I'm going to ask with kind of a philosophical question, which you sort of touched on, but I'd like you to kind of expand it. Looking at the music you were making then and looking at the music that's now, why do you think people from this era, even kids from this era, latch on to those older songs?
You know, I can't really sit here and, you know, and really, I'm not going to knock anything here, but all I can tell you is that there's, if those songs were not memorable, then kids wouldn't latch on to them that much. So in other words, you've got a good catchy, you've got catchy hooks, you've got catchy music in there, easy to play, simplicity, lyrics that probably are you know, simple and right to the point without beating around the bush too much and stuff. And it's just good, fun music, too, you know, which is very important, too. I mean, we've got enough, there's enough, you know, going on in the world now that we don't need to bring it up anyways. But it's just that, you know, to capturing the true spirit of rock and roll, which is when all those guys were coming up with the stuff back in the 50s, you know, like Little Richard and Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and, everybody else from that time frame. It's all fun music, you know, and it's supposed to make people happy in the long run.
We've been talking with Wally Palmer, and to remind you, Wally's band, The Romantics, along with The Smithereens, Marshall Crenshaw, and Tommy Tutone, will all be playing the Mayo Performing Arts Center in Morristown. The date is August 7th. For more information, you can go to mayoarts.org. Wally, I want to thank you very much for taking the time from your schedule to talk with us, and thanks for keeping these songs alive and keeping that spirit alive.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show, Bill, and actually, we look forward to, you know, to doing that show, and we're going to be bouncing around the East Coast quite a bit, so if you hear or see us playing somewhere in your area, please come out and check it out.
Okay. For Contours and for WNTI, this has been Bill Nutt.
All Seasons Recreational Vehicles of Easton, Pennsylvania. Located on Route 248, All Seasons RV offers new and used RVs for sale and parts and service for Winnebago RVs and trailers and surveyor trailers. More information available online at allseasonsrvs.com or by phone 610-253-7700. All Seasons Recreational Vehicles, a proud supporter of WNTI Stage.
Anyone who feels that there are no new standards being written anymore has not heard Bobby Caldwell. Bobby Caldwell has been doing his best not only to perpetuate the Great American Songbook, but to expand it with his own compositions. We are so fortunate that he'll be bringing his six-piece band right here to the Lackland Center as part of Centenary Stage Company's Summerfest. He'll be performing on the 9th of August, and it's a pleasure for me to look across the microphone and say, Bobby Caldwell, welcome to the WNTI studios.
Well, thanks, Bill, for having me. Appreciate it.
Do you think of yourself as a standards singer, or is it all just music to you?
That's a good point, and I think a point well taken. It is pretty much all just music to me. However, you know, I definitely have an inner affinity for the standards. I love doing them.
When did you know that you had to be a singer?
Oh, wow. Well, my folks were in television and theater, and I was always kind of surrounded by that group of people who were also involved in the arts, and it was kind of like almost genetically unavoidable for me.
Did your parents both sing? Did they actually sing?
Or
were
yes, they did.
They were.
Yeah. They sang and danced and acted.
Now, it's one thing to say, all right, I'm going to be a singer. I'm going to be a performer. It's another thing to say, I want to write songs myself. When did you make that leap?
Another great question. You know, the thought of that being the end game never occurred to me when I was like 10, 11, 12 years old and I first started thinking seriously about this may be what I want to do. I never thought to myself at that age, you know, I want to write songs. It was more about, I guess, performing. And of course, I wasn't thinking about a recording career back then. All of those elements of, you know, such a career just never occurred to me at that point in time. But eventually, you know, I did start to write the first songs I would never want you to hear.
Well, who were your models? Who did you, because very few people start out fully blown as their own selves. Who were your role models as songwriters?
It's weird. In my youth, it was Lennon and McCartney and all the underground stuff that was going on. Big influences on me. And as I started to grow into my teens, late teens, it was Motown in Philadelphia. And I didn't get into the American songbook, although I had been exposed to it my entire life. And, you know, the likes of Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald and Tony Bennett and the great songwriters from that era, like Johnny Mercer and who's the guy that wrote Come Rain or Come Shine? Escapes me right now.
That was Mercer, wasn't it?
No, it was not. It was not. It'll come to me. Once I stop thinking about it, it'll come to me. At any rate, I kind of did a flip in my middle adulthood and started rediscovering the American Songbook and the songs I was exposed to as a child, and realized that I had so much in the game with this music and knew so much about singing it and emoting the tunes, being a Sinatra study. I felt, you know, this would be something I'd want to really take a look at, and so did.
Well, forgive me for making assumptions here, but I think people of our age, when we grew up, when you watched variety shows on TV, you were watching the old performers. You were watching Sinatra. You were watching Dean Martin.
Yeah.
You were watching those, what now consider old school people. The idea of a rock variety show, you didn't have that in the 60s. Unless it was maybe one night a week.
Well, yeah, you had the shindigs and the hullabaloos
and bandstand.
But they weren't based on people's personalities. There was a host. And I think it's a pretty safe bet that, you know, a lot of the Rocketeers, you know, didn't necessarily have the kind of personalities that lent themselves to, like, comedy mm-hmm. or drama.
Right.
All the things that, you know, Sinatra and Dean Martin and Sammy Davis, Lawford as the Rat Pack, you know, they all seem to be able to handle all those positions. So, yeah, that era, at least for me, it's sorely missed. And the way variety shows were back then, even the early days of Carson, it was just a fantastic moment.
Mm-hmm.
When people would crash the show and were uninvited guests, it was some of the best television I can remember.
It was spontaneous.
Yeah.
It was real. Even if it wasn't live, it felt real.
But it was live. At least the era of Carson I was talking
the
about.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. We're talking with Bobby Caldwell here. All right. So you've kind of progressed into that standard mode. Tell me about your earliest performing as a professional. Did you feel that... Did you feel comfortable enough? Did you feel you had enough preparation when you actually started performing that it was very easy to segue into the songwriting and doing the full package?
Wow. So shall I include the styles in this?
Yes, please.
Well, before I actually, you know, came to the epiphany, I have to have a recording deal as a young, you know, aspiring artist. I had written songs, none of which actually appeared on my debut album. So I kind of was given carte blanche in the studio after years of being rejected. And so, you know, carrying around this shopping bag full of tapes, I decided, you know, I'd take a step back and start fresh on what was, you know, my first endeavor. And so obviously all those songs were written by myself. And certainly more than appeared on the album. I mean, I got rid of the stuff that, you know, didn't seem to catch much attention in the beginnings of the record. So after the record was the hit that it was, and it was giant and still huge, it went on to be, you know, like a mainstay, almost a standard of pop music.
And that's kind of what I meant when I said a new standard at the beginning. Tell me about that song, please.
Well, I'll tell you the best story I could tell about the song is that I had completed this debut album after beating myself up real good for 6 months and getting so close, I couldn't see the forest through the trees, you know. When I delivered the album, What You Won't Do for Love was not on the record, nor had it been written.
Really?
Really. And this was a label based out of Hialeah, Florida, that had, you know, huge success, especially in the disco genre, like with Casey and the Sunshine Band.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty much their flagship act. So while the label really thought, you know, the album was, you know, a great piece of work, they, quote, didn't hear my breakout single on the record. And, you know, after all this blood, sweat, and tears, I go back in haste, without giving it any thought at all, and in 2 days record What You Won't Do for Love. There's, you know, there's a lesson to be learned there, if you care to learn it, which I did. But this album kind of dictated to me who I was, you know, with, you know, the worldwide acceptance it had. It, when you're a young artist and looking for your niche, your identity, ultimately, if you have that kind of breakout debut album, the people tell you if it's going to fly or not. And because it did, that was who I became, this blue-eyed soul singer. It wasn't until albums later that I revisited, you know, the American Songbook.
Mm-hmm.
Not only because I felt I could, but as, you know, I guess a departure, just to give myself a break from what I had been accustomed to doing, and do something that I, you know, I knew I would have fun doing and did, given the trappings of the recording studio, which was, you know, CBS in Hollywood, Columbia.
Wow.
I mean, you're talking about just decades and decades of memorabilia, microphone lockers that, you know, were just filled with some of the most expensive mics now. Some of them can't even be found. And, of course, you know, the incredible recordings that were made in this particular room. It just made for, you know, a lot of fun and a great couple of records.
So let's kind of fast forward.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, we are talking with Bobby Caldwell, who will be playing the Lackland Center on August 9th. So when you come here to Hackettstown and you're going to be performing, what's a Bobby Caldwell show in 2014 like? What do you do now?
Well, this will be my third performance here. Each time it was with the orchestra. I'm glad I made that choice. And it was originally a fellow who I know you know. I won't mention his name on mic, but he used to book a lot of the acts for the summer series.
Mm-hmm.
And he was hell-bent on, you know, having me do the orchestra and was familiar with the couple of albums that I did. Had actually, you know, seen me do it live. I think it was in New York. And I found, you know, after the first engagement here, you know, it was perfect for the demographic that was coming to the shows. So this year we're bringing in pretty much, I think it's the same orchestra I had. Most of the same players, but we're going to be featuring songs that are going to be embodied on a forthcoming album that I start recording in a little under 3 weeks right now.
I was going to ask you if there were any upcoming projects that you could talk about.
Yeah, well, they're kind of tied in because we will have already recorded the album, and I'll be using a lot of the same players, bringing them here to Centenary. So while these are not original songs, they're obscure in their nature, but I'm sure they'll ring a bell with a lot of people. And we're keeping some of the things we did last year that went over so well.
Can you give us any teasers of what's going to be on the new album or what you're going to do, or do you prefer to not?
Well, sure, I'll give you some song titles.
You give me some tantalizing things here, non-originals, okay. Obscurities. That's...
First, let me preface this by saying, you know, it was never my intention to, you know, become a Sinatra impersonator.
Okay.
Nor was it my intention to only pick Sinatra songs. It seems that, you know, at least during his era, the best songwriters were writing for one guy. And so he got pretty much the cream of the crop. And it's consequence that the songs I loved were done by Sinatra, although I do happen to like, I love Billy May's arrangements, Nelson Riddle and all that stuff. So what we're recording in 3 weeks, and also bringing a lot to the stage as far as material, are these obscure Sinatra songs that aren't readily well known. Mm-hmm. One of them is called I Only Have Eyes for You, which he did with Count Basie on their one and only studio recording. A tune called Yellow Days, which he did with Duke Ellington on the only album they did together. Saturday Night is the Loneliest Night of the Week. Please Be Kind, which is a little known Sinatra song. And The Very Thought of You. Moonlight in Vermont. In the Wee Small Hours of the Morning.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be doing most, if not all, of the songs that we're going to be putting on the new album.
Interesting. And spicing it up, now you mentioned some of the songs that were done last year. What were some of the ones that the audience here really responded to?
You Make Me Feel So Young, Fly Me to the Moon, Day In, Day Out, the more readily known Sinatra things,
sure.
Under My Skin, Street of Dreams,
mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of stuff like that, World on a String. So, and you know, it's like, it's at the point in time where I need to reintroduce the show and put new material in it, just to keep it alive for the players and for the audience.
And for you.
And for me. Yeah.
talking with Bobby Caldwell here. Now, Bobby, you've been doing this long enough that I'm really curious to know your perspective. You've seen trends come and go in music. Right now, where do you feel the Great American Songbook is as far as its acceptance by audiences, regardless of age?
Okay. Yeah, that's a fair question. I think it's in as good a place as it's ever been. And when you think back, we actually have Natalie Cole to thank for reintroducing this kind of music, the American Songbook, to the public, and you know the brilliant thing she did with Unforgettable. It made something that previously might have been considered corny by all ages, well, not all ages, the youth, let's pinpoint that. She made it, you know, hip again. And so many artists, you know, have come along. Brian Setzer, Michael Bublé, even Rod Stewart, to kind of carry the torch for these standards. And I think it's in a good spot right now. The more popular music disintegrates and, you know, goes generic where everything has a tendency to sound the same. I think in a lot of ways, you know, the youth is looking for something with more substance. And that's certainly not all of them. And may never be. But as long as we don't let go of that, you know, that incredible era of songwriting, I'm more than content, you know. I see a lot of young people in our audiences when we do the orchestra.
That's nice to hear.
The same fans that go to my R&B shows, mm-hmm. You know, they seem to readily accept it, and not, you know, not wonder why I'm not doing, you know, the thing I'm most known for, which is the blue-eyed soul stuff.
Right.
So in that respect, you know, my fans came along for the ride and continue to do that, which is encouraging for music from that era.
And what about for your own songwriting? Because I always feel like once, and of course I'm speaking on the outside because I've never written a song in my life, but I would think that once you have written songs, it's very difficult not to write songs. Do you have an outlet for your own songs that you're looking to put out there?
Another great question. You know, if I look at the last 35 years, there was a portion of that from the beginning of my, especially from the beginning of my first album, where I was just constantly writing. Somewhere between 15 and 20 years, constantly writing. And now I kind of write when I have a project coming up. I'm going to write for the moment. Just, you know, my work ethic has changed. Attention to detail and, you know, being a stickler for perfection, that hasn't changed. Although I've kind of learned to take my lumps on some things. Now, as the years roll on, you kind of get beaten down a little bit. But, you know, I have noticed the change. So I'm not writing 365 days a year.
But when the time comes, when the time's right, and you feel the need, you're doing it.
Well, the need, to be quite honest, it would be out of necessity, you mm-hmm. know, to have product mm-hmm. On a reasonably continuous basis. And, you know, I've kind of reached the point in my life where, you know, if I sit down to write something and it's not happening, I'll walk away. Or maybe I'll start something that I'm unable to finish that keeps calling me back, which is kind of like a green light that it needs to be finished. So a lot of new things have come into play as far as a writer, especially, you know, given what's going on today. And I see more and more, you know, the young artists today reaching back into the old bag and trying to find and cover songs that, like I said earlier, just have, you know, more lyric substance or more memorable melodies. And I think that's a good sign as to where we're headed.
We've been talking with Bobby Caldwell. And Bobby, I have one last question. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm not putting you on the spot when I say ask this. You've been doing this for a while now. Are you doing now what you had hoped you would be doing when you made the decision that you wanted to be a performer?
I never dreamt that I'd be, you know, performing. Well, like, if we're talking about, you know, the age of 14 or so, I never envisioned myself as a crooner in front of a big band. But am I liking being able to do that right now? Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's just a matter of time before, you know, I probably won't be on stage performing What You Won't Do for Love. I don't know when that day is going to come, but it will come. In the meantime, I've got this thing, you know, that only me and a handful of other people embrace, you know, as artists. So I'm a, I guess I'm one of those big fish, you know. And I count myself among the talents, you know, that I'm appreciative that they're still doing it. It's great. And that Bublé has the success he does is just better for me.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking with Bobby Caldwell, and to remind you, Bobby Caldwell and his orchestra, I guess it's, we can call it an orchestra, 16 pieces is an orchestra. Bobby Caldwell and his orchestra will be playing at the Lackland Center as part of Centenary Stage Company's Summerfest series. The performance is Saturday, August 9th. For more information, you can go to www.centenarystageco.org. Bobby, thank you very, very much for taking the time to visit us here in the studio, and thank you for coming out. We're looking forward to seeing you on the 9th.
Well, thanks, Bill, for having me.
For Contours and for WNTI, this has been Bill Nutt.
That's it for this week's edition of Contours, your weekly roundup of what's happening in the WNTI listening area and the surrounding communities. Thanks to everyone who made today's show possible. Contours is a production of WNTI and can be heard Sundays at 9 a.m. with a rebroadcast on the web, WNTI.org. Thanks for tuning in today and stay tuned for Jazz Bob Bernotis and On the Dance Floor, coming up next on 91.9 WNTI Public Radio from Centenary College. I'm Melanie Teal, Contours host and executive producer. Have a great week, everyone.